Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with Ian Dark, John Rawling and myself, Tris Dixon. You guys might notice that there is no said order for that. No one is the A-side of this boxing show. But one thing I will say is officially, this podcast is flying high because we are now up to position number 6 in the category of sports in Thailand. So we are absolutely flying at the moment. Guys, we said we would do a Q&A this week, and so let's kick off with that. We've got an assortment of questions. Not surprising, given the week boxing's had. A lot of them do center around the Ben and Eubank controversy, and this wasn't designed Ringside Rewind. It was meant to be a look back over more nostalgic moments of our boxing, of our time in boxing. But this is where we are, front and center this week. People do want to talk about this. So we've got a question here from Rob Gilly. How badly does it reflect on the British Boxing Board of Control that they only prohibited the Eubank Ben fight once they knew the Daily Mail were running the story of the failed drug test? Does the organisation need a major overhaul? I mean, one thing I'll just say about that in terms of facts is all of the results are provided by VADA to the parties concerned. And then obviously Eddie Hearn's been talking about the legalities of this. So the board don't suspend or act on VADA results. They're just made aware of them. They act on UCAD results. So it's a slippery slope legally. But John, would you like to have first dibs at that one?
Well, I think you've kind of answered it in what you've just said there. I think the Boxing Board of Control is running scared. Potentially, if they get sued and are liable for huge amounts of money, if the action were to go against them, which at this stage would seem to be unlikely, but if the action does go against them, they would be in a lot of trouble financially as a governing body. But it does leave an uncomfortable taste when you know that the test was taken, what date we're talking, the positive September 23rd
was when they were made aware of the results.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, there's a lot of time there. And the thing which I feel very, very uncomfortable about from both the board's perspective and indeed the promoter's perspective is that they went on selling this, and people who were ready to go to London have put a lot of money in organising transport, organising hotels, and whether or not they're ever going to get their money back, let alone the fighters on the undercard, Chris Eubank, if they're going to get paid. But I think that the British boxing public has been hugely hurt by this. And the fact that there was a positive apparently announced on September 23rd suggests to me that this could have been dealt with very much quicker.
Ian, anything you'd like to add?
Well, I think it's just an unholy mess. And in a way, I always feel sorry for the British Boxing Board of Control, because I think it's pretty well known that they are not a wealthy organisation. So John used the phrase running scared. I don't really think that's fair on Robert Smith and the board, because they are in the financial situation they are in. They can't afford to be sued for huge amounts of money. Otherwise, they'd go out of business. And let's face it, they're kind of like the governors of a banana republic, aren't they? It's a chaotic business, boxing. And what's happened here, I think, you know, is terrible. As you've said, who knew what and when about this failed test? I mean, the board are splitting hairs. It was a UCAT test or it was a VADA test. The fact is he failed a dope test. The blame lies with Conor Benn for this, really. There is no, I mean, providing there's confirmation on the B sample of his test that there's not some big mistake here. He's to blame for it all. But then people like Eddie Hearn and the promoters of the organization, you know, they've hired lawyers and tried to find loopholes to get the fight on. And that, frankly, is a disgrace. And you know what? I'm a bit fed up with reading these stories saying boxing's name's been dragged through the gutter again. We've been reading stories like that for, you know, I'm reminded of Bert Sugar's old line, you know, when somebody asked him that. And he said, didn't boxing run out of reputation around 1910? It's boring. I mean, if Watford sack, you know, 8 managers in a year, has football's name been dragged through the gutter? Or if one athlete gets done for drugs, has Athletic's name been dragged through the gutter, or that one guy? So, yeah, those are my feelings. Like John, I feel really sorry for the undercard fighters who trained for fights in good faith and won't get their money now. And I feel sorry for Chris Eubank Jr. as well, because as far as we know, he was on course to make the weight and do the fight, and he's lost out big time as well.
Yes, but Chris Eubank Jr.'s stock has risen this week. He seems like he's gone from pantomime villain like his old man to hero of the week. Yes, sorry, John.
I was just going to say, can I just add something? Somebody contacted me, a very well-known figure. I'll not name him because for obvious reasons. But he said that the Varda test tests positive. And then the defence would appear to be that subsequent UK anti-doping tests negative, and therefore it's okay. And that was a loophole they were looking at, that they might be able to move on. You know, I mean, he pointed out to me, this guy who's got experience in athletics and in boxing, if somebody fails a drug test on one particular day, by the time another test is taken, maybe even only a day later or 2 days later or whatever, then that drug in the system can be out of the system by that time. So a negative test at that point proves nothing.
Yeah. So, you know, I think I started to look at this at a different angle yesterday. And this morning I've woken up and I'm almost, the whole situation, I've obviously written a big piece on boxing scene. It's kind of not moved me today. In the sense that I think I've been ground down to a bit of a halt this week by it. But what I was thinking is that really, you know, you would love the promoters, and I know I'm going to put ethical in the same word, in the same line here, which is kind of oxymoronic, but you'd love the promoters to think, hang on, we've got a positive test. Let's not put this show on straight away, rather than rely on the border control or anything else. Like, you know, when you talk about a bill of goods that you're trying to sell, you know, you want the guys to be clean, healthy, and as risk-free as possible. And you know, surely as a promoter, you'd be like, oh, you know, we shouldn't be putting this on straight away, regardless of what the border control said.
Mm. Well, on the face of it, you know, they've put money first. Guess what? Boxing promoter putting money first. There's a shock horror story. But no, you're right. You're absolutely right. And just imagine if the fight had gone ahead, worst case scenario, and Ben seriously hurts Eubank in the fight.
It doesn't.
The legal ramifications of that for Eddie Hearn would have been huge, because, you know, what kind of charge could you face that you knowingly put on a fight where one of the fighters had been artificially beefed up for extra power, if that is confirmed? Of course, we'll add that for legal reasons. But so I'm surprised it wasn't an immediate decision to say, we can't do this.
Yeah, and I think obviously when you talk about the ramifications for Eddie, I think it's ramifications for the sport as a whole, because, you know, feasibly, you know, they could have worked the loopholes to make the fight happen anyway. Similar question here from Stephen Gage, who says, hi, chaps, what's the future of the Boxing Border Control? Are they a relevant organisation moving forward for boxing? Do we need a rethink on how objective they might possibly be? Before I let you at that one, John, which I suppose is going to overlap a little bit with that first question, I will say I think the Border Control are decent, but we take it for granted because it seems to be a steady answer. Oh, our border control is up there with the best in the world. I'm not convinced that many of them are great, and I'm not sure that that's not being damned with faint praise, because there's so many bad ones out there that there's no excuse for us not to keep moving forward with the border control. And I think Rob Smith will argue that he is, but I still think it is lacking in certain areas. John, do you think we need this overhaul, or do you think that they are, do you think we need a rethink on how objective they might possibly be?
Well, you know, I mean, they're funded, are they not, by the sport? So indirectly, they're funded by the promoters and the fighters who might be complicit in any sort of abuse of the doping system. So you could argue that they are kind of tied up in all this to a degree, and also are ultimately a little toothless, because if they go in there and kick people and really hammer people, then they're going to leave themselves open to a big, painful bounce back from the very people who are funding them. So I think it's a very, very difficult situation. And whether or not, I wonder if somewhere within the government, whether somebody might be looking at this and saying, hey, do you think that it's time that we took some sort of a role in this? But, you know, I mean, you know well enough, Triz, and you, Ian, even if the Boxing Board of Control were to be given greater powers somehow, if that actually can be done, you know, they're just, people involved would just sidestep. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see Ben Eubank, even if bans are imposed one way or another in the UK, I wouldn't be at all surprised to see this fight still cropping up somewhere else.
Yeah, we could see it in Saudi Arabia, for instance. Hey, before, Ian, let me go to you with a different kind. Let's lighten the mood somewhat here. So Martin Clark says, if you could pick one fight to commentate on, I guess that's in current boxing, what would it be, and who would be your co-coms?
Oh, well, I suppose in current boxing, you'd probably say Fury against Usyk, wouldn't you? You know, if that fight happens, or Fury against AJ, although of course that was a 50-50 fight that's turned into a probably something like an 80-20 fight. Now, you know, like a lot of fights, it's not past its sale by date. I think it still sells loads and loads of tickets. But going back in history, I'd have to say the Rumble in the Jungle, because not even I am old enough to have covered that one, but I've heard a lot of stories from the guys who did. You know, imagine sitting there in Zaire when that absolute sensation happened, and Muhammad Ali regained the title using the most audacious strategy any fighter ever invented for any fight, you know, letting George Foreman unload on him for 8 rounds and then taking him out. So, yeah. That would be my one, and I'm not going to pick between them. I'd have either Glenn McCrory or Jim Watt sitting beside me, he said diplomatically.
I like it. You could have them both. I think for an occasion,
yeah, that big, you could have them both. Absolutely. Yeah.
John, how about you? I mean, if you've got a current one and a past one, let's do that.
Well, I mean, my past one, it's hard to go further from where Ian was. You know, if you would if you talk about, you know, sort of books in sport, The Fight by Norman Mailer is one of the great books about that very fight in Zaire. And if you still talk to those who are old enough to have been there, like Colin Hart, like Alan Hubbard, their eyes light up when they talk about that one. I remember as a sort of a film of my youth, if you like, watching that fight and just being mesmerized by it. And to commentate on that would have been sensational. Of the modern fights, you know, I hear what you're saying about the Fury fights. Do you know, the one I'd like to see is Anthony Joshua against Deontay Wilder. I think that would be an extraordinary fight and would be very, very difficult to call one way or the other. And the guy I'd like to have alongside me, well, you know, I'll have my usual partners, you know, Richie Wood, Barry Jones, etc. But I have Tyson Fury on that commentary team as well, watching that fight. I think that would make some very good TV.
You can't afford it, John.
I like it.
I've got Evander Holyfield to commentate for free with us on the Mike Tyson Buster Douglas. But I think I've told that story before, haven't I? About how I bumped into him in the lift and said, what are you doing? And he came and commentated.
That's great stuff.
He went downstairs and said, hey, guess who I've just met in the lift? It's Ian Dark.
And they said, who?
Mike Hills asked, so I'll start with you on this one, John. I want we've touched upon this actually, but Mike Hill says, I want the boys to compare UK boxing broadcasting over USA broadcasting, and who is the champion?
Well, on the other side of the pond, I always liked the Showtime way of doing it. I thought, and I still think they've got the better team of anybody out there now. I love hearing Al Bernstein with a microphone in his hand. You know, he goes back such a long way, and he still talks with passion and with such admiration, I think, of boxers. He's still has huge respect for anybody with the guts to step through the ropes. Steve Farhood, I think, is a very good commentator. And of interviewers, I very much like Jim Gray, who's been around a long time, but he's got real balls, that man. If it's a difficult question to be asked, he will ask it. He's not just some pretty face up there ticking a box one way or another for his involvement or her involvement or whatever. He gets in there and really asks hard journalistic questions. And I think that makes Showtime, for me, on that side of the pond, certainly the preeminent force.
Ian?
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with most of what John said there, but, you know, the HBO team are super professional as well. You know, Jim Lampley, he's been doing it now for, you know, a long, long time. He's a great commentator. Larry Merchant, I always loved him because, like, as you described Jim Gray there on the other channel, Larry had that dry way of really sort of pricking the egos of boxers as well. You know, the famous Roy Jones one where Roy Jones is going on about, you know, Roy Jones is the fastest boxer on the planet and nobody can live with Roy Jones. And he says, you know, when you're talking about Roy Jones, don't you mean you? I mean, I liked Larry. He had a journalistic background. I mean, I've got tremendous respect, really, for nearly everybody who broadcasts the sport because, you know, the commentating business isn't easy. I mean, I agree with John. Al Bernstein is beautiful to listen to talking about boxing. Steve Farhood as well, you know, knows it all like the back of his hand. So who's the champion between? I mean, I think the question was, who's the champions between the Americans and us, wasn't it? But, yeah. I mean, I always say the same thing with that. You know, your judgment of commentators and commentary teams is purely subjective. It's down to you what you like. I'm guessing that a British audience or some of the British audience might find the American style a little bit too busy because there's, you know, they never let it breathe at all. They're talking all the time at you. It's a high energy broadcast. So maybe they've got used to the British style and they might find that just a little bit of a jolt. Having said that, I think quite a lot of the British audience would quite like the American way of doing it too. So it's down to you, isn't it? It's the beauty is in the ear of the beholder this time, if I can twist that little phrase.
Chris, can I just add something to that? I mean, we both have people who contact us, and I'm sure you do as well, saying what a shame that we can't go back to the good old days of Harry and Reg, Harry Carpenter and Reg Guttridge. And if you listen to the way they did it, particularly Harry, talking about let it breathe, they certainly did. And a lot less was said, and it was a lot more allowing the action to tell the story. And there's still, boxing commentary styles evolve as they go along, don't they? But a lot of people out there would still like to see that form of commentary. And it's not just, you know, your old farts. It's some young people as well would rather just have a chance to just watch the fight and not have facts sort of pushed down their throat or being lectured at, some of them feel, by certain commentators who maybe they think just simply talk too much.
Yeah, I mean, I tell you what, you'd say commentary styles evolve. They really, really do. And they didn't always talk all the time in the United States. I'll tell you a story. I was asked to do a revoice. They said, can you revoice The Thriller in Manila and The Rumble in the Jungle? We're putting out as a two-fight video for sale. I said, I'm not going to revoice that. I said, everybody knows I wasn't at the fights. I can't do that. They said, yeah, but the commentary on it is like, there's hardly anything said. And it was Don Dumphy, who was a famous, commentator going way back, who did it. But his style, you know, way back then, and I'm sure that, you know, that might have been the vogue then. You know, all hell was breaking loose in the ring in the Thriller in Manila. And he's just saying, Frazier's landed another great shot there. And, you know, there'd be another 20-second gap because Ollie still looks strong to me. And on it would go like that. So I got why they wanted it revoiced for the current market. But I wasn't going to put a commentary on that because I think it's, to use your word from earlier on, Tris, a little bit unethical.
Hey, in fact, one thing I do want to shout out the current ESPN team here. I think that they are really solid. So you've got Joe Tessitore on commentary, but Mark Kriegel, who I think is a really good storyteller and is a very good writer as well. And as an analyst, you've got Tim Bradley and Andre Ward, and you can't go really too far wrong with those guys.
That's a good team. That's a good team. Yeah.
Chris Wardrope asks, I like, you've got to put up with the first part of this question to make the second part count. Chris asks, if either Ian or John had fought professionally, okay.
Been a very short career.
Yeah, exactly.
Which trainer would they have wanted in their corner and why? And I do like that second part because obviously you would have got an intricate knowledge and feel for coaches over the years. So John, let's start with you. Who would you have in your corner and why?
Well, assuming I wasn't going to go a huge distance in the sport, I'd certainly like somebody who cared for my welfare and somebody who really fought for the sport and for his fighters. And of the current sort of small hall promoters, trainers, I don't think you can go very much past Carl Greaves. I think he does a fantastic job in the Midlands, both in small promotions and for the fighters he looks after. He's a committed man of great integrity. You know, I mean, going back a few years and still involved now, I suppose Jimmy Tibbs, Mark Tibbs, his son, they've got a lot going for them. And of worldwide sort of superstar trainers, I think the guy I always admired immensely was Manny Stewart.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't beat Manny. Manny Stewart, obviously. Frankly, if I was to turn professional boxer, first of all, I'd want somebody with medical qualifications in the corner. Doctor, maybe a priest. No, I mean, because you know, we say that and we're making jokes. Of course, we're making jokes about it. But I just want to say, I still am in awe of every professional fighter who gets through the ropes. You never heard me in any commentary describe anybody as being a bottler or anything like that. You're brave to be in there in the first place. So, but my answer, I think, you know, is going back in history, really, as you might expect. I'd say Eddie Futch. You know, remember what he did in the Thriller in Manila. You know, at the end of the 14th round, Joe Frazier wouldn't talk to him for a year or two after that. And, you know, the famous line about sit down, son, it's over, but nobody's ever going to forget what you did here tonight. And that's what you want in your corner, a compassionate guy who's going to look after you because, you, in a way, fighters are way too brave for their own good and they need somebody in that corner to look after them. So, yeah, I think Eddie Futch would be my choice. I mean, of a slightly more modern era, you know, I can think of, you know, Brendan Ingle and Brian Hughes, who I both had enormous respect for during my time covering the sport and you know the job they did not only as trainers but for their community as well.
So Ian, basically what you're saying is if you fought pro, no one would forget what you did there that night.
they certainly wouldn't. No, not in the way you might expect though.
What was the quickest ever knockout in boxing?
Well, wasn't there one, that one with Nigel Benn when he knocked out that bloke in 16 seconds? And I said to him in the interview, I said, just as well you finished it then. I had you behind on points at the time, Nigel. And he did laugh.
That's good stuff. Another one from Chris, by the way, which I like. This is sort of heavy on nostalgia. Do you think Mike Tyson's career would have been vastly different had he stayed with Kevin Rooney throughout, or was it always destined to be boom and bust inside and outside the ring? Ian?
I've got a feeling it probably wouldn't have been that much different because I think, you know, Mike Tyson's wiring was a little mixed up, let's put it that way, in those days. Rooney was in charge, and obviously he was a really good trainer for Tyson at that time, but it was when Tyson was, if he was ever lower profile. It was around the time Rooney was with him, wasn't it? In those earlier stages of his career. I just get the feeling, you heard stories later that even then in the Customato days, they were having to keep certain things, trying to work very hard to keep certain things out of the press about, you know, Tyson's wilder side, let's put it that way, and various antics. So I think the story probably would have evolved pretty much in the way that it did when he became that major celebrity and took his eye off the ball, as he did in the build-up to the Buster Douglas fight, you know, when he started to try to cut corners. Maybe if Rooney had been with him around then, maybe Rooney would have got him to refocus and said, come on, you know, you've got to treat this guy every single fight seriously. He obviously didn't take the Buster Douglas fight that seriously and paid the price we all know about.
I'd like to hear what you think about this one, Tris, because I mean, obviously, you know people around that as well as anybody. I mean, I personally, from just looking at it from a little bit further away, if you like, I think the man he really missed was not so much Kevin Rooney, but Customato. Because Customato was the father figure, the mentor figure. And when he went off his life, that restraint, that parent substitute, if you like, was taken away. And it's fairly self-evident that Don King was no replacement for that. And when Caton and Jacobs, when their management was taken away also, then it all became a little bit unhinged and self-indulgent. And yeah, I mean, if Kevin Rooney had been there, I hear what Ian said, he might have been able to arrest the decline. But I think that at some point, Tyson was always going to implode.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the death of Jim Jacobs was another one. It was another hammer blow, wasn't it? So, and then the split with Kevin, which was ugly and went through the courts. I think we have this romantic notion, don't we, of these partnerships and how they'd be unbeatable. Like, if Naz had stayed with Brendan all the way through, would he have been unbeaten? We love the stories, don't we? We'd love to think that Tyson would have reigned until 2000 and beyond and be able to keep a lid on everything. But I kind of now I'm a bit older and a bit more wiser and a bit more cynical. I probably do think, like Ian, he was probably going to blow at some point. And literally the nature of the beast, I guess. Yeah. And I think that's where we are. But I would love, you know, obviously what a story that would have been if he'd be able to follow through and stay in Catskill and all the rest of it. It would have been tremendous.
Yeah, I mean, the Tyson of Mike 1988 against any heavyweight in history would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah, I think you have to say it. And we really saw a round of it against Lennox, didn't he? When he came out and he had one good round in him, but you know, the Tyson of the late 80s was a fierce proposition. So Rob Morris says, John, you've sort of answered this briefly on Twitter, so I'll let you have this one. How many times can boxing shoot itself in the foot before it's no longer considered viable? I think I'm not sure there's anything below the knee left, is there?
Boxing's always had this sort of this ludicrous ability to seem somehow shaft itself. You know, you look back to the days of Mob Connections, we talk about fixed fights, there have been deaths in the ring, nowadays drug scandals, but you know, you'd be naive to think that hasn't been there for decades. But it's always been on the edge, boxing, hasn't it? To an extent, it's kind of the Wild West barroom saloon of international sports. Yeah. And in Wild West barrooms, you don't see too much steady play, I don't think. And in a sense, yeah, okay, it's shot itself in the foot. But in a sense, that, corruption, for want of a better word, is part of what makes it fascinating to so many people. And you look at some of the great people who've written about the sport. You know, I talk about Norman Mailer, but more recently, you know, we've had some of the best journalism in the UK has come out of boxing writing. And I think that part of what its fascination is, if we're really, you know, sort of bleakly realistic about this, we like to unravel the intrigue and the skullduggery which seemingly always surrounds it.
So, Ian, I'll come to you with a different question, unless you wanted to answer that one as well.
Well, I will actually. He's right about the great writing, isn't he, Malem? I mean, you think of, you know, the late Hugh McIlvenny, you know, but by the anthology of his boxing writing, if you're a big boxing fan, absolutely fantastic. How many times has boxing shot itself in the foot? I'd say it's about 3,948 and counting at the moment. And every time, boxing obituaries are written, probably sometimes too, by really good columnists who probably should know better, because if you look in the coffin every time, there actually isn't a body. John's right. There is, you know, it's sad to say, and it's probably not even a PC thing to say, but people do like that cowboy kind of chaotic dark side that boxing has. I mean, it keeps on retaining its appeal. Okay, it may be not as high profile now as it was, you know, back in the 1950s and 1960s or 1940s, even just after the war, you know, the huge kind of crowd. But you're still getting 80,000 people turning up to see Groves and Frotch fighting at Wembley, the huge crowds at the O2. So the sport, despite its detractors, and despite, you know, the idiocy and terrible mess of this Ben Eubank business, it will still retain its appeal. And they will still, you know, one day after all that had happened, if they'd have put tickets on sale for Fury against Joshua, if it was happening, it would have still sold out in 2 hours.
So I think it's interesting. I'm one of the doom mongers right now, and thinking that the death knell could be around. And I know that you've been around obviously longer than I have and seen more than I have. But, you know, we've lost amateur boxing from the Olympics, and it's been taken away from us because we can't get our own house in order. And I think, you know, there's going to be, I've said this in the column that I've written this week, there is a ticking time bomb in boxing, and it will go at some point. And I'm not sure what it's going to be. People will say, oh, bombs have gone off left, right and centre. And they maybe have. But there's going to be a watershed moment. And I've got a feeling that we're on the brink. I really do.
Well, I respect your opinion, Tris. You're probably a bit more clued into everything that's going on in the current scene than I am. But, you know, I think boxing's always bounced back before. I think one of the big worries is this. A lot of the big fights now are pay-per-view, and they've been pay-per-view in the United States now for the best part of 40 years, people being charged, you know, $50, $65. I've spoken to a lot of people because I work sometimes with ESPN in the United States, and there's a lot of the young producers there, and they're all sportsman guys. They've never seen boxing. They never saw Oscar De La Hoya. They never saw Felix Trinidad. They never saw Barrera and Morales and all those great fights. And they said, yeah, well, you know, it sounds great, but we never see it anymore because it's always on pay-per-view, and we couldn't afford it back then. So that's a worry. That is a worry in the United States. And if boxing's in recession there, it's a pretty bad sign, isn't it? So,
well, that falls into the next question, which is great from Steve King. Why has boxing become a niche sport? And I will give, I think I've got four things here, and then I'll pass to you, John, to lead the way. I would say because the newspaper coverage is greater diminished. A lot of editors don't like it and don't follow it across all platforms. The big fights aren't being made. Worse than that, they're being constantly teased. And then there's all the chaos with the titles. And this is before we get to any of the red light district stuff that we've alluded to. And I think those are the things. Title chaos, big fights not being made, editors disliking it, and lack of mainstream coverage. John, anything you care to add?
Well, we live in a very much increasingly PC world, don't we, globally? And having a sport where legally two people can seemingly, for the uninitiated, go inside four ropes and attempt to beat each other's brains out doesn't really sit too comfortably with that sort of underlying script. I think TV fragmentation has been a large part of it. The fact that everybody who covers a fight seemingly wants to have a title fight or wants to have belts involved. So obviously they become very much less important the more of them there are around. And I think the change in the media has been massive. You know, people talk about social media as being good for sport and good for profile. I'm not convinced it is. It's anarchic, isn't it? It gives everybody a view, and most of those views are ill-informed and often, you know, sort of on the borderline of poisonous. And I think the decline of newspapers and, to a lesser extent, mainstream television and radio has been, to a fairly significant part, involved in the decline of boxing's popularity.
Ian?
Yeah, and also the rise of the Premier League in England as well, because, you know, there are pages and pages and pages about football. I work in football, so I'm not gonna knock that. It is the national sport and it is the national obsession. But it does mean that there's less room in the newspapers for other sports. Yeah, boxing, it probably has receded to be a niche sport now. But you could say the same really about golf, horse racing, athletics. All of those sports probably get less room in the newspapers than they used to, less airtime. But I don't have a perception out there at the moment. Really, I don't quite share your doom, Tris. I still hear plenty of chat going on. I turn on Talk Sport or Five Live. There's still plenty of boxing chat going on. They've got a special hour that they have on Talk Sport. I think it's Thursday. Spencer Oliver comes on. You know, I don't remember that happening too often in the past. And, you know, you'd have the stuff with Mike Costello and Steve Bunce when Mike was at BBC Radio. You know, all that kind of thing. There's plenty of debate going on. I still think the interest is there in the sport, but it's certainly having to fight its corner. No pun intended. You know, more than in the past. But everything you said, Tris, is quite right. I mean, it's a long running thing, isn't it? The multiplicity of titles. I remember, you know, you used to get things like, this is for the IBF interim pentacontinental light welterweight title. I mean, it sounded like something like a hotel at Heathrow. You know, I used to joke on air. We're getting to a state soon where we're going to have more titles than boxers. So it was just sticking labels on the fights. So yeah, that's got to stop. Really, we don't need it.
I mean, one thing that I'll say in terms, just to add to Ian, what you said there is, Ian, obviously you're more versed in this than John and I, but the amount of money that goes in Premier League rights, imagine if some of that went in boxing. You know, some of that TV money, which is billions now, isn't it? Or certainly hundreds of millions.
I mean, Now the worldwide global television rights for the Premier League are more than the domestic broadcasters are paying. So it's not only big business in Britain, it's big business all around the world, which is why clubs halfway down the Premier League, like Crystal Palace, have got more money to spend than Juventus. So that's what's happened. I mean,
but it's also why TV networks don't have the same coffers for boxing, because the money's being taken up elsewhere trying to scrap for the rights.
Well, that's true. I mean, and the rights holders, or the live TV rights holders, are Sky Sports, of course, and BT Sport in Britain. You know, Match of the Day don't have to pay too much money. The BBC, but the BBC can't spend, you know, they can't morally spend the license fee on boxing, but they'll still dip into their coffers if it's a really big one, you know, like it's a Fury v Joshua world heavyweight title fight, say.
Yeah, but it only happens, does it not? It only happens at that sort of level if it's a pay-per-view to make it viable. Because you know, you remember back 30 years, Ian, to when Eubank and Ben were fighting. That was. You know, I mean, the major fights then were terrestrial television. ITV was providing the money then. So, you know, that's how the landscape's changed. And they were, those two guys, for those big fights, they were earning figures in the region of £1 million each, which at that time was absolutely immense. But it's inconceivable now to think that a terrestrial channel could put up enough money put on a major fight at a time of prime time television.
Yeah, well, BBC tried with, you remember they did that deal for Audley Harrison, which wasn't the best idea. for many reasons at the time. You know, that, there was that. But yeah, when do you see boxing on peak time, BBC or ITV nowadays? You're right. I mean, when Reg and Jim were doing those ITV fights, 30 years ago or so, they were on peak time on a Saturday night. And that made boxing very, very big around that time, because everybody had seen it and would be talking around about the fights, you know, when they went to work on Monday morning.
So we've got one here from this is, I guess, in tribute to the late, great Harold Lederman, who was a friend of mine, but it's from Geraldo Lederman. Best boxing books ever written. John, fancy kicking us off? Best boxing books.
Gosh, there's a few here. Well, I already mentioned The Fight by Norman Mailer, which I loved as a book. Some people, I think, regard it as a little bit too sort of much navel gazing and a bit too pretentious, but I love the writing style. I like the book about Jack Johnson, Unforgivable Blackness. That's certainly always worth a read. I think Thomas Hauser's Ali book, you know, you can talk Night Train about Sonny Liston, Nick Totchus. But, you know, of all the books, the one I always tell people, if you're into boxing, if you remember the great era of fighting, let's talk about the 1980s and about Tommy Hearns, Marvin Hagler, Roberto Duran and Sugar Ray Leonard. And if you're into that, and if you do, I think you're talking about the best era in boxing in our lifetime, then read Four Kings by George Kimball. George was a sort of a Vietnam veteran. He was a hard drinker. He liked to smoke, not always tobacco. He was a fun guy to be around. Sadly, no longer with us. But my goodness, he wrote a great book, Four Kings.
Yeah, I agree totally with you, John, about that. We had a night out with George Kimball once in Boston when Ricky Hatton fought there. And he was big mates with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And he said, I'll tell you what, he said, why don't we go down the road? My mate Stephen Stills is playing a solo gig. I said, is he? I said, yeah, come down. So we sat there and he played all Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young stuff all night. And that was George. Then he took us back to his apartment in Boston and we drank some fairly strong stuff, I think, you know, whiskeys for the night and felt a bit the worse for wear. But that was, I mean, his book is great about that. I mean, John's listed all the big ones. I think the only one you didn't list there, John, was The Black Lights. That one about, you know, if you really want to get inside the boxing business and you don't know it from the outside. It's about Billy Costello, isn't it?
That's right, yeah. The Thomas Hauser, wonderful book, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the Thomas Hauser one, The Life and Times of Muhammad Ali, that is the definitive book for me on the many written about Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, and I'm disappointed that my book there in the background, Road to Nowhere, hasn't even got a mention. So
Road to Nowhere by Trish Dixon. Wow.
I mean, I'm not even saying that's a plug, but Ian, I'm gonna nick that soundbite and I'm gonna play that for years to come.
Buy it. I'm gonna say it now. Trish Dixon's book, Road to Nowhere. Buy it now.
Oh dear, I don't think they print it anymore, mate.
I won't even pay you for the voiceover either, Tris.
Great stuff. So this one from I'm going to say at Graham, he's got a lot of numbers on after his name. There's two parts to this: favorite and worst fight venues. So let's go with that. Favorite and worst fight venues.
Favorite, and my favorite, I think I'm going to say the Royal Albert Hall. Now that's going back. It was wonderful because just about everywhere there, you were kind of like, you had a great view of the fight. You were part of it. And it had that sort of almost regal feel about it, around it. You know, it was a beautifully appointed boxing venue. And obviously the York Hall at Bethnal Green as well, which is going to get mentions from us all. I mean, it's so intimate. And there's very, very rarely any trouble there because they're all boxing cognoscenti, aren't they? Everybody's seen it all. They've seen all the fights and all the fighters coming through at the York Hall Bethnal Green. So I always used to like that, and I particularly liked it because there was a very good Greasy Spoon cafe opposite where I could go
still
and
there.
Have a
still there.
Yeah.
It's still there.
Egg. I mean, they did a wonderful sausage, egg and chips and a nice cup of tea. I mean, you know, they think that we live a plush life as commentators. Now we're in the Greasy Spoon Cafe with the trainers there, nice big mug of tea. That was our that was before. So I mean, in America, I'd say outdoors at Caesar's Palace, where I saw Marvin Hagler and Tommy Hearns fight. So those are my three, anyway.
In America, I like Madison Square Garden. I know it's not the easiest place to work for a variety of reasons, but it's just the history and being right in the middle of downtown New York. I think Madison Square Garden has a special atmosphere about it. In the UK, I mean, we've really moved things on with our stadium fights, haven't we? We could talk about Cardiff. We can talk about Wembley. You know, you name it. We've got so many great venues, but I love your call. There was a quote I saw on the on social media somewhere attributed to Marcus McDonald, and he said, "Yeah, your call's a shithole, isn't it? But it's our but it's our shithole." it's so much a part of boxing. And, you know, I mean, some fighters just always wanted to be involved there. Were you there, Ian, the night that Johnny Tapia fought? And yeah. people were clinging to the rafters, weren't they? I've never seen more people in the place. I think the fight that she was involved in only lasted about 90 seconds before he won. But you could see that it really meant something to the little fella to be there in the East End fighting among a just passionately enthusiastic crowd. It was brilliant.
It was idolatry, wasn't it, that night? But he asked for worse venues as well. And I'm going to put up, because people don't realize this. They think, you know, John and I just go to these big swish fight venues and cover massive fights. Most of the career as a boxing commentator is spent, you know, because we used to have to do boxing every Saturday night. There wasn't a big fight every Saturday night. So we used to end up at a place called the Harvey Haddon Leisure Centre, somewhere on the outskirts of Nottingham. I was never sure where, only my sat-nav got me there. But it was really very soulless. And to be honest, the fights that were put on there were, let's put it this way, not ones that would live too long in the memory. So I'm going to put the Harvey Haddon Leisure Centre up.
Yeah, some of those leisure centres live long in the memory, don't they? There were some pretty ropey ones that, you know, on the old Sky loop around the country, where you'd be doing some of these cards. And obviously, you know, as with us, Boxing News, first people in, first people out. You were there before there was a crowd. And you're like, oh, when this gets busy, it's not going to look great. And most of them never got busy.
It never got busy. I mean, I remember, do you remember when Chris Eubank had his world tour, which is a promotion idea? They even send out great big pamphlets and handouts about it. The Chris Eubank world tour. But, you know, for a while, it never went much further than Belfast or Cardiff. And I used to jab, it's a joke saying, you know, have we had our jabs for this world tour yet, to Frank Warren?
That was great stuff. Yeah, I mean, in terms of venues that stand out to me, I mean, I love, for the same reason you said about the Albert Hall, the Home Depot Center in Carson in LA is the tennis courts. It's I went there for when Oscar De La Hoya had his homecoming against Stevie Forbes. I did it in the football stadium, and it wasn't a sellout, but I went to that. But the night before, they had fights in the tennis center, and it was so well stacked up. And I actually think the Arthur Ashe Stadium in Queens would be a fantastic boxing venue.
Yeah.
Because this, you know, it's kind of like the Royal Albert Hall, but outside. And obviously the weather's, you know, was delightful at the time. And then I think there is something about, John, you know, where you touch about upon Madison Square Garden. I remember my first time in there for Hopkins Trinidad and just being in awe of the place, and even going up the escalators just thinking, wow, these are hallowed halls. Same thing really now with, I think, the MGM Grand. I think there's so much boxing history in there, you can't help but think, you know, it's every step is a boxing museum. And and then, you know, in terms of the York Hall, you'd have to have the York Hall in there. But then, you know, it's very sad, and I sort of visit every time I go, but the old Blue Horizon in Philadelphia as well, which was basically their equivalent of the York Hall with the balcony and all the rest of it. And, you know, so much great history in that place too.
We can't really let this one go without mentioning Belfast. You know, I mean, the venues over there, Ian.
Yeah, King's Hall. Barry McGuigan at the King's Hall. Dave McCauley, amazing. Great atmosphere, seething.
Yeah, and I think the Frampton Knights at the Odyssey were top draw as well. You know, deafening stuff, deafening. They're absolutely deafening. Split, you know, ear splitting screams from people. It was amazing stuff. Amazing.
I went to the Cobo Hall in Detroit one night as well, and I remember it. I think it was it might have been Dennis Andrews fighting against Tommy Hearns, and we had to walk back alongside by some river because we couldn't get any car. Afterwards, and we were walking by this river with Glenn McCrory, and I said to halfway, I said, "I bet the HBO lot don't have to do this after dark in Detroit." And he said, "I know, it's the murder capital of the world as well." I said, "Thanks for that, Glenn. Thanks for the reminder at 1 o'clock in the morning by some river in Detroit."
Okay, so some good stuff there. Let's do a couple more. We're not going to get to them all, but let's do a couple more. So Stuart Watt says, John, I'll start with you. Who was someone in the game that you thought would be a nightmare to be around and turned out to be really nice, and vice versa?
Well, I'm not sure nice is the right word. Nice is the right word. But I tell you, somebody who was always, always amusing to be around, and he may have been evil, he may have been dangerous. We all know his history about him kicking a man to death because of the numbers racket. But to just actually be around those big fights 20, 30 years ago, I mean, Don King, you thought he was going to be something appalling, but it was actually quite good fun to be around a promotion where he was there. And if you actually went out socially, he was also pretty interesting. I know Frank...
You went out socially with Don King?
Well, really? We did. Yeah, did we? Yeah.
Really? Where?
I've sat in bars in Las Vegas and had a drink with Don King. I mean, Frank Warren would tell you about the time he took him to a curry house in Stevenage or somewhere. He walked in with Don King and the place just couldn't believe it. So I think the owner thought, my God, I can make some money here. And of course, Don had about four meals while he was in there. But yeah, he was. You can say he was evil, and in some ways, maybe a lot of fighters would say that was the case, but he was also fascinating to be around.
Larry Holmes wouldn't agree with you, John. Read Larry Holmes. But by the way, that's another book. The Larry Holmes one, I think, is good. I can't remember what it was, but he tells...
Against All Odds, that one. Against All Odds,
yeah. It's back there in your nice library there. Yeah, no, I'd have to disagree with Don there. I thought Don King would be unpleasant, and he was. that's why I agree with that. I mean, oh, I don't know, flip side round. I don't know, Bob Arum always had that sort of rather suave kind of air, didn't he? You know, completely unlike Don King. But, I mean, he could be quite nasty at times as well, and turn on you if the mood took him. So... he was the famous line, which I did an interview with him once, Bob Arum, about, you know, Duran and Leonard, and he was great about all that. But I said, did you really say that about, you know, yesterday I was telling, you know, yesterday I was lying, today I'm telling the truth? And he got really defensive. No, I didn't say that at all. Why are you bringing that up? And I said, it's only a bit of a joke. I said, most of us have a laugh about it, Bob. And he goes, well, I don't think it's funny. And
well, he admitted it the next day.
Yeah. Great line, Chris.
Okay, so I mean, one I'll add to that, by the way, from Stuart's question there. Who was someone in the game that you thought would be a nightmare to be around and turned out to be really nice? I mean, again, we're stretching the really nice, but when I went and interviewed Mike Tyson for BT Sport a couple of years ago, you obviously don't know what Mike you're going to find. And we got Mike, who was, what should we say here? I don't know if inhibited's the word, or assisted. Mellow, extremely mellow and extremely happy and extremely cheery to have some British guests. Yeah. And you go there, obviously, with some trepidation, thinking, you know, this guy's launched TVs and broken film cameras and all the rest of it. And I just had one of the most memorable afternoons of my entire career with him laughing his head off for about 2 hours, trying to get out lines for BT and doing an interview about the first fight between Fury and Wilder. And I went there, like I said, enormous amounts of trepidation. not nervous, but thinking, you know, I don't want to blow this for BT Sport. And and he ended up having the time of his life and having an absolute ball with us, which was great. So I think that will always stand out. Let's do one more. I think people do like the retro stuff. So this one from Alex Winston. Would love to hear more of yours and Ian Dark's memories of Mickey Duff. Seems like a character from a completely bygone era. Mickey, I only met once. I'll give you guys a couple of minutes just to think of an answer for that. I met Mickey once. It was at the International Boxing Hall of Fame. It was my first visit there. And I was actually stood there with Matthew Saad Mohammed, who I just bumped into. I actually tell part of this story in my new book, Warrior, which will be one of the ones that you'll be adding to your list of great boxing books.
Buy it tomorrow.
It's not out yet, Ian. but still, and I was there with Matthew Saad Mohammed, and Mickey Duff came over. And Mickey was still in good shape at the time. And Matthew and Mickey had this great bit of banter between them, because Matthew had beaten John Conti twice, Louis Pergo and Lotti Moali. He'd knocked back four of Duff's fighters, or in four different fights, he'd knocked back three Duff fighters. And so they had this history from 25 years earlier. And it was great to see them sharing the moment. And we were somehow engaged in a conversation, and someone, I think a random stranger, came up and snapped a picture of the three of us, which is one of my favorite pictures of me, Mickey Duff and Matthew Saad Mohammed. But you guys knew Mickey far better than I did. So, John, you can kick us off.
Well, I'll just give a recollection of what he was like. I remember when I first started working for Radio Sport down in London. We're talking, you know, sort of, I don't know, around about 1984, 85, something like that. And I was sent down to Mickey Duff's office in Soho to go and do an interview for him for the 6:45 sports desk, which we used to have in those days, previewing some fight or other, which I've long since forgotten which fight it was. But I went down there, obviously a little bit nervous and a little bit in awe of this man, because I'd never met him before. And I thought, what am I going to have? Anyway, I get shown through by his secretary, sit down next to this enormous desk where he's speaking in this sort of boardroom type place, which functioned as his office. And he picks up the phone, and he had the most animated, screaming row with somebody over that phone that you could possibly have ever seen. Veins were standing out on his neck, in his head, in his temple. It was incandescent with rage, the sheer anger pouring out of him down this phone. Well, I later found out that it was a business conversation he was having with Jarvis Astaire, who was his partner. Anyway, he puts the phone down, and it's almost as though the light has been switched on. From being this ranting maniac, he just turns to me and says, "Right, so what would you like to talk about?" that was Mickey. You could turn it on and off, and when he wanted to be, he could be super charming.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a few memories of, because that was my very early days working at BBC Radio. And I used to work alongside Des Lynam to begin with. And one of the early assignments was we flew to Houston, to the Houston Astrodome, Pat Cowdell against the late, great Salvador Sanchez. And we're sitting at breakfast the day before the fight. And some guy, one from the American side of the promotion, comes over. Mickey Duff's sitting with me and Des for breakfast. And he goes, "Are you the guys from BBC Radio?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You don't have any rights for this fight. You don't. There's nothing in the contract about BBC Radio doing the fight." And Mickey Duff said, "Hand me the contract." So the guy hands him the contract, and he handwrote at the bottom of the contract, "BBC Radio will cover the fight live." He goes, "That should sort it out." and that was it. I mean, the other, you talk about Mickey Duff's office. In the morning, Mickey'd had a press conference to announce, and I can't remember the reasons why now, that John L. Gardner was going to be relinquishing the British heavyweight title. So in the afternoon, I had to go down to Mickey's office for something else, and John L. Gardner was sitting there. So we're both sitting outside waiting to see Mickey. And so I start a conversation with John. I said, "It's a bit of a shame you had to give up the British title." And he goes, "Have I?" I said, sorry to break. I said, well, you just had a press conference this morning to say that they've obviously got some other plans for you. And he went mad. He went, Mickey! He wanted to bang the door. He goes, have I given up the British title? Mickey Duff opens the door. He says, calm down, John. Why have you had to tell him that, Ian? I said, you announced it at a press conference this morning. That was hilarious. And, you know, he was very pragmatic. But, of course, he was the king, wasn't he? You know, until Frank Warren came along. You know, they ran the show for a long, long time. So you'd have to say, yeah, he was smart.
And yeah, I mean, hugely respected also in America. You know, people like Teddy Atlas still talk about him with great reverence. And yeah. I think people do know when you talk about him being smart, this is a guy who had this incredible memory, right, John, who could memorize just about knew every phone number that you needed to know off the top of his head.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that is so much the case. And it's kind of the savage irony of Mickey's life, isn't it? That somebody who was mentally so alert should ultimately be ground down by dementia in the way in which he was in his latter years, which was, I mean, a lot of people are affected by that awful ailment, disease, if you want to call it that. But to see Mickey reduced as he was pretty heartbreaking for those who loved him and knew him well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because Bob Meade did his book, didn't he? And Bob had to fill in a lot of the gaps himself in the end. I think we can reveal that now. Of course, one of Mickey's other great lines was, I mean, his relationship with Lloyd Hannigan, which was pretty strained, really, between boxer and promoter. And one of the journalists asked him at the press conference and said, how does it work then with you and Lloyd Hannigan? Because you don't seem to get on. And Mickey said, there's nothing in the contract that says we have to like each other.
That's great stuff.
Yeah.
That's great stuff. Right, guys, let's draw a line under it today. I think that's been a lot of fun. We've covered a lot of ground. I think we should do more of these Q&As. I think once we've got the taste of Ben and Eubank out of our mouths, we'll probably be asked a lot more nostalgic stuff, which I think is probably our strongest suit. But before I leave you, I would like you, the listener, to, if you can, spread the word about Ringside Rewind. If you can, please give us a rating, a 5-star rating on iTunes and wherever you listen to this podcast. If you could leave a review, that would be fabulous. And if you could share, whether you're enjoying it and want to share links with a friend, then please do that as well. This was Ringside Rewind. I'm Tris Dixon. This is Ian Dark and John Rawling as well. Thank you very much for joining us. We will be back next week. Or will we? Am I lying or am I telling the truth?
Yeah. Well, I'd just like to say we've all been dope tested and we're clean.
And buy Tris's book.
buy it now. Road to Nowhere.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.